Okay, folks, you are listening to the latest chapter, the latest series of adventures, the latest happenings here on Planet Porky, with myself, the Porkmeister, and, of course, the Rockchick writer extraordinaire, Miss Leslie Ann Jones. Miss Jones, I hope you are well, and thank you for the invitation you've recently sent me to a big event at St. Bride's. Tell me, please, what I am going to be seeing at that wonderful, magnificent journalist church when I come to this service in November.
Ah, Mr. Parry, that's the Journalists Commemorative Service,
right?
An annual event where we have very high-profile journalists, editors, producers, people who run television companies, that kind of thing.
Wow.
And it's a celebration of all who have fallen in the name of bringing the news to the world.
Right.
So we are the Journalist Church. We have always celebrated our press. We are right in the heart of what used to be the center of our newspaper industry,
yeah,
where we all worked, mm-hmm, in our newspaper offices up and down Fleet Street and so on.
Yeah.
And St. Bride's is the last man standing, if you like, isn't it? It's the spiritual home of journalism.
I lash myself every weekend when I think, well, I could go to St. Bride's and go to the church service, the one that you attend every week. But for some unknown reason, you know, there's always, I'm working the next day or I've been working the night before or something like that. But I must literally get up there and we should have a lunch afterwards somewhere in Fleet Street. You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, let's do that. But we've got a magnificent programme of Christmas services coming up as well,
right,
which we do every year.
Yeah.
And, of course, Fleet Street carols, which you would have attended,
yes,
many, many times,
yes,
back in the day. Do you remember those days when the crowd was so huge, it was spilling out the back doors?
Oh,
there wasn't standing room only.
Absolutely. I mean, my very good friend, Mr. Alan Brazil, is not a particularly godly man, if you see what I mean. I'm not saying he's ungodly.
But he's the devil.
But he loves the carol service. We've been there several times and been to the carol service and, you know, sung all the, you know, God rest ye merry gentlemen, may nothing you dismay.
That's a pretty fine singing voice you've got there.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Parry.
It's a baritone. And Mr. Brazil fancies himself as a bit of a singer. But we genuinely do enjoy it. We used to know the Reverend Canon Oates very well. He was rector there for many, many years, wasn't he?
Well, he was in church a couple of weeks ago, actually. He came in for...
I thought he died and somebody had taken
He's well into his 90s.
Wow.
Yes. And we had a little chat afterwards. It's quite funny because he's always known me as Sally Ann.
Mm.
He actually baptised my first daughter and oversaw her confirmation classes,
golly,
as well,
yeah,
when she was confirmed by the Bishop of London, who was then Richard Charger, if you remember.
Yeah.
And he still remembers me, and it's a bit too late to disabuse him of the fact that I'm not called Sally Ann, if you know what I mean.
That's fantastic. Well,
let it go.
He does take a drink, doesn't he, Canon Oates?
I wouldn't call him an alcoholic.
No, he's not alcoholic, but the reason I'm saying is I don't want to defile his name, but, you know, we all used to get into terrible trouble in Fleet Street sometimes. A story got published that was later found to have inaccuracies in it, or you'd upset one of your editors, or you'd fallen out with somebody. And we used to go across the road, because, of course, I was in the Express building, the Black Lubyanka, right opposite St. Bride's. Sorry, why am I going mad?
More or less opposite the Fleet Street entrance.
It is, absolutely, the Iron Gate. That's right, yeah. And we'd go and find him in the wine bar at the bottom of St. Bride's Street, you know, down at the bottom there, little wine bar.
Oh, that's the Humble Grape nowadays.
Yeah, that's Humble Grape.
Yeah, it's a nice building.
It is, but it used to be called something related to Caxton. You know, the Caxton Press was the first.
Yeah, there's the foundations of the St. Bride's Institute are there,
yes,
as well.
Right, yeah.
And the St. Bride's Institute was once Henry VIII's London residence.
Wow, fantastico.
It's great history there.
Yes.
But, you know, and the building that used to be the City Golf Club.
Yes.
Where do you remember?
Yes.
We all had a yellow membership card.
Yes, of course.
That was I've still got mine.
Yeah.
And it was basically an afternoon drinking club.
Yeah,
nobody
yeah
played golf in the city.
No, that's
but
right.
It was just an excuse to keep the doors
yeah
open.
That's a gin palace now, by the way.
It is a gin palace, and I was going to suggest that we go there.
Yeah, maybe. Yeah, good idea.
For old time's sake.
Indeed, you go down the stairs again. But by the way, when I say gin palace, I'm not being derogatory to them. They literally distill their own gin and sell different gins. I know that because I was down that way one morning and the punch hadn't opened. You know, not the punch, the bell. The bell.
The bell. That has brilliant history because that was built by Sir Christopher Wren, who was building St. Bride's. And the bell, the old bell, was built as an inn, a hostel, to house the builders who were creating the church.
And it's fantastic history. Just for the benefit of our millions of listeners, the old bell is on Fleet Street at the front. But at the back, you go out the back door and you can walk straight into St. Bride's Churchyard. I mean, it's a wonderful connection, isn't it? You can come in the front, have a few pints, go out the back and go straight to the church. It's a wonderful building.
Yeah, so you can go and sin and then go into church and say sorry for it.
Yeah, you can. My voice is getting a bit croaky. I'm sorry about that, Miss Jones.
Have a swig.
Talking.
Have a swig, darling.
Yeah, I've got a coffee here. Anyway, so yes, so I'm looking forward. Yes, I was going to say, so we go and find Canon Oates, and then after a few drinks and Canon Oates' soothing words, you thought, oh, perhaps it's not that bad after all, and then go back and give your editor a mouthful, you know, for shouting at you in the first place and all that kind of stuff. But
the wonderful thing about Canon John Oates is he was very, well, he is, he's still alive. He's an incredibly human person. Yeah. His feet are firmly planted on the ground, and there isn't anything he hasn't seen. Yeah. And I remember his retirement dinner. They had a wonderful dinner for him at Claridge's. Mm. And the great and the good all came. You know, every newspaper editor was there. We all dressed up, hair piled high, long frocks, the whole works. Yeah. I think I even had elbow-length gloves on that night. It was very posh.
Yeah.
And he stood up and he said, his opening line to his address was, I think I know something incriminating about every single person in this room.
Wow. Yeah, I can believe it.
Because everyone had been and sort of confessed and asked his advice. Yeah. You know, not that we have formal confession in the Anglican Church, but you know, in times of trouble, people would run to him for his advice.
That's right, absolutely. So there we are. Right, now talking about, we mentioned something, I can't remember what it was, but, yes. Did we mention Glasgow there? Or Scottish. Oh, Mr. Brazil, that's right, right. So Mr. Alan Brazil.
A tenuous link, if I may say.
A tenuous link, but he comes from Glasgow. Now, I've read this report, and it's the most ridiculous survey I've ever come across, because it can't possibly be true. It says here, number one city to ditch booze is Glasgow. People are more likely to be teetotal in Glasgow than in any other British city, a poll suggests. That is absolute and utter nonsense. I'm not saying they've got the report wrong. I'm saying that whoever interpreted it needs to stay off the drink or put more water in their whiskey.
Well, I read a couple of these reports. Yeah. It's one of these wellness firms that did a survey, isn't it? And the claim was that 22% of those quizzed. So imagine, you know, if they only quizzed five people, just saying, you never know how many people are involved in the survey, but 22% of those quizzed said that they never drink alcohol. Mm. Now, I've got three friends who live in Glasgow who are Glaswegians who never drink. They are all musicians. Really? So what does that tell
you? God, they can't be members of Wet, Wet, Wet then, can they?
Well, no, but it suggests to me, because these are people of a certain age, that, you know, musos back in the day liked to drink. We all know that. Yeah. People either outgrow that habit or they give it up for some other reason, usually for their health. Yeah. So it depends on the age of the people that they quizzed as well.
Well, I've been to Glasgow, you know, dozens of times. We've done live shows up there in Socky Hall Street. A night out in Socky Hall Street. Can I be beaten? And we, Alan and I have done football shows there, you know, fans forums, and been to football matches there. I've been to the Celtic Rangers match at both Celtic Park, which is Celtic ground, and at Ibrox, which is Rangers ground. And, you know, as far as I'm concerned, the city floats on a lake of beer and wine and booze, because, and I don't mean that in a bad way at all. It's a happy city. You know, it's a party city. People are out at night. Hamilton Square, I think, isn't it? No, or St George's Square, somewhere. Carlton St George. That's a hotel we stay in on George Square, and it's a beautiful hotel because if you're staying there, the top floor is an open bar. You know what I mean? The lift goes up to the top floor, door opened. You walk in, where all the booze is free. You know, there are decanters of whiskey and gin and rum, and it's like a private club, and you sit there and watch the telly and have a few sherbets. I love Glasgow, honestly, I love it to bits, but I cannot believe that it's the number one city. So they say Cardiff and Norwich are also top for teetotalers. Cardiff, I know very well, because when Wembley was knocked down, the cup final was played every year at the Millennium in Cardiff's England games. I've seen England play there against Wales, obviously. And I think Cardiff's a great fun city as well. So I don't know. I don't know who's been doing the research for this. I've never been to Norwich, actually.
I've been to Norwich, yeah. It's a bit flat, really, but I know a couple of people who live there too. I think, going back to what I said before, it all depends on the age and the circumstances.
Yes, I agree.
Younger people they quiz.
Younger people disappoint me dreadfully these days, all this nonsense about, you know, living well and cutting out booze and, you know, eating lots of these, like, tofaloo foods or whatever they're called.
Tofu, you mean?
Tofu, is it? Yeah.
Tofu. Tofaloo is the girl who won the I'm a Celebrity, Get Me Out of Here. Oh, okay. Georgia Toffoli, wasn't it?
Oh, was it? Yeah, okay. Yeah.
The girl they call Toff. Oh, a bit close to Boris Johnson's dad, Stanley.
Oh, right, okay. Oh, interesting, yeah. But anyway, look, there is...
Not that I'm starting any rumours.
No, of course not, no.
It's a family show.
That's right. Anyway, the study of 2,500 Brits by wellness drinks firm, won't give them a name, found the booziest city was York, where just 5% were teetotal. So that's it. I'm moving to York, Miss Jones, okay?
No, I don't think you are.
York, Oxford, the top five non-teetotal cities, York, Oxford, Sheffield, that's two in Yorkshire already, Southampton, and fifth, London. Well, we all know about London, but London's too big to really specify. But York is a beautiful city, by the way. I love York Minster, the church.
It is lovely up there. Liz Jones moved up there, but she really regrets that she moved to Yorkshire and wishes that she'd never left London.
Yeah.
But you're from Cheshire. You were born in Cheshire, yes?
Yes, born and brought up.
So what do you call yourself? Is it a Cheshian?
No, a Cestrian.
A Cestrian, that's a good word. Sounds like you were born in a cesspit.
No. That's very kind, Miss. That's very unkind, Miss Jones. No, people from Chester, where I come from, are Cestrians. And do you know what? I've been thinking more and more lately, ever since the lockdown, and you know, you had to spend more time at home because there was nowhere else to go. You couldn't go to work, couldn't go to the pub or anything. I started thinking, I've got to start renovating my home because I'm spending more time here. And for most of the last 20 years, I've had two homes. I've got a second one now in Suffolk, but I had one on the south coast. And what I did was I kept my second home immaculately in good order, because I only used it like one or two days a week, if that. You know, it was one or two days a weekend, a fortnight usually. But everything was immaculate because hardly anything had been used. Do you see what I mean? You know, you weren't using them every day. You weren't using, you know, the bed every day. You weren't using the couches and the cooker, and everything was sparkingly immaculate. But when you do that, your main home suddenly starts to degenerate, because you don't apply the same care. So, for instance, I've had to be in the business of getting new windows put in because I only realised for the first time, hang on, these are getting a bit old and all that kind of stuff, you know what I mean? But getting back to the point I'm making, the older I get, the more I have a yearning to go back to my roots. And I'm thinking very seriously now of relocating back to Chester.
I suppose it makes sense because as we age, we are not so desperate to be out there on the scene, part of the party, part of the action. We've done all that. Yeah. We've been there, done it, got the T-shirt, at the cast. You know, the appeal of being in with the in crowd does begin to wane. And when we're younger, we never think that's going to happen. We always think, got to be close to the action, can't ever duck out, you know, got to be seen, be out there. But that does wear off.
Oh, it does. I turn down more work than I take on now. And that's not a boast, but the point is I get rung up all the time. Do you want to do this? Do you want to do that? Do you want to do that? And frankly, if I don't like the idea of it, I just say, no, I don't really think that's for me. Whereas years ago, I'd have, you know, bitten somebody's arm off to get onto television or radio or something like that. You know what I mean? And you're absolutely right. It's just being more choosy now about what you do. And that thing about the in crowd, by the way, did you read this week about David Dimbleby, who said what I've said for years, I don't have any friends. He literally said, no, I don't have any friends. I've never wanted friends. I think he's in his kind of 90s now or something, certainly late 80s, I think. And he just said, I have no interest in having friends. and I'm not a lot of people will admit that, but I do because that's the way I feel.
It does. That, again, wears off as you get older. My father was a very gregarious man when he was younger, yeah, and was always socialising. My mum and dad gave lots of parties. Yeah. You know, they knew hundreds of people. They were always travelling around the world, visiting people here, there and everywhere. Yeah. My dad, in his later years, there was something very sad about driving down their road and pulling into their driveway and seeing my father sitting on a little couch in the front sitting room, yeah, just looking out the window, almost as though he was hoping somebody would come to see him. Yeah. And the only people who came to see him in the later years, yeah, were us, his children. Yeah. And Mum said, you know, he knew so many people back in the day. I said, yeah, but everybody got old. Nobody goes anywhere anymore.
That's true.
People just sit in their homes, yeah, staring out the window, and yeah, that is the future, unfortunately.
Yeah, it won't be the future for me. I think we've had this conversation before. I'm never going to become inactive. If I become inactive, then I will accelerate my my stairway to heaven.
Well, how are you going to do that?
Well, just by not, you know, giving in to sort of immobility or something like that. George Harrison, before he died, and of course he's one of our heroes, I remember a quote from him saying, it wasn't from him, it was from a friend, an associate or somebody close to him, said, George isn't worried about dying, he's quite excited about what comes next. And I think that's quite a good way to look at it, you know what I mean?
He was a very spiritual man in his later years. Yeah. His wife, Olivia, his widow, spoke in a documentary after his death, yeah, about something incredible and extraordinary that happened at the moment he died. She wouldn't divulge what it was. Yeah. She said that it was far too personal. It was between him and her.
Right.
And she would never share what it was. But she said, mm, it was such an uplifting thing that took place, yeah, in front of her very eyes that convinced her that everything was fine.
Well, I met a woman once who was a widow at a very young age. She was widowed at about 38 after she found out that her husband had some, you know, terrible cancer or something like that. And, I saw this woman for a few months and all that. She told me that at the bedside when her husband died, she literally saw what she described as a firework take off out of his body and fizz around the room, you know, emitting sparks and energy and, you know, just fizz. And then it disappeared out of the window. She said, I said, you must have been your mind. She said, no. She said, I saw it. It went around the room a few times. It went up and down. It fizzed and it left off, like clouds of smoke and that kind of stuff, and then disappeared out the window.
Well, it's interesting, isn't it? Because there was a lot of cynicism around the time when Her Majesty died, mm, and rainbows were appearing all over the place. And people were seeing images of Her Majesty in clouds up in the sky, yeah, and so on. Yeah. And people were making fun of this. Oh, it's an absolute nonsense, wishful thinking. Mm. I must tell you that when my father was in the hospital, his last couple of days, yeah, we were all there. Yeah. The whole family was there. We were with him. I didn't quite make it to be with him the moment he passed, but the day before, after the priest came in to give the last rites, yeah, my auntie said to me, look out the window there, and it was, you know how black the sky sometimes gets,
yes,
when a storm is about to come,
yes,
and in this blackness, it was about 4 in the afternoon, this rainbow just kind of rose outside the window, yeah, and it was almost like, she said, it's like a bridge, mm, it was like my dad's bridge come to take him to the next place. Right. And everybody scoffed at us and said, don't be ridiculous. You're seeing things. But there was the rainbow. We weren't seeing it. Yeah. It was there.
That's a
so who knows? Who knows? None of us can say what's coming.
You're absolutely right about the rainbows, though. There was they were all over the place, weren't they? I saw a picture of the day of a circular rainbow. I don't know if you've ever seen one, but apparently you can, get circular rainbows, and a helicopter flew through a circular rainbow and took a picture of it. It was amazing. Anyway, there we go. Miss Jones, I want to talk to you about an old colleague of ours in Fleet Street. I suppose I worked on the same paper as him, but you would work with him. I'm talking about Garth Pearce, right?
Oh, lovely Garth Pearce. We love Garth Pearce.
Garth Pearce. Now, I don't know why, but he wrote a big spread in a paper this week. He is he's given the title Garth Pearce, author and James Bond expert, right? Apparently,
well, he did a series of books, didn't he? The making of. So he did the making of GoldenEye, the making of Tomorrow Never Dies, and all that. Yeah. So the stories behind the films. He's a bit obsessed with James Bond, I think.
Yeah. Well, apparently he is acknowledged as one of the world's greatest experts on James Bond. And the reason he wrote this piece was to celebrate the 60th anniversary of the release of the James Bond film, Dr. No.
And well, that was the first one, wasn't it?
It was the first one. And it's a fantastic read. I don't know if you saw it yourself. If you haven't, I'll send it to you. But, James Bond nearly didn't happen because of all the chaos that surrounded the filming of the first film. The budget ran out, the Americans who were financing it said it's not good enough and all this kind of stuff. And the way Garth writes it was, the only guy who was absolutely calm all the way through all this confusion and rewriting and reshooting was Sean Connery himself, who just lay back on the beach because a lot of it was filmed in the Caribbean, Jamaica. And he just said, no, just give me a shout when I've got to do the next set. And all the chaos was going on around him. But it's fantastic.
Is he your favourite James Bond, Sean Connery?
Well, when you look back, I didn't realise the first words he ever spoke was when he had that cigarette in his mouth at the roulette table and was asked his name. And he said, Bond, James Bond. And those are the first words he ever spoke to James Bond. Look,
predictably, one would have to say.
Yeah, exactly. Look, because he was the first, he's obviously the image that comes into most people's heads. But I actually liked Roger Moore because I thought Roger Moore managed to blend the serious side of the business with a twinkle in his eye all the time. And also, my favourite opening, because I love the opening to James Bond films. Sometimes if I see there's a James Bond film on, I only want to watch the first 5 minutes because there's always a fantastically, action-packed opening before the credits come up. And the one I love most is The Spy Who Loved Me, when Roger Moore skis off the end of a mountain and you think he's done for, and then his parachute opens and it's a Union Jack parachute and he floats to Earth, and then the theme tune comes in, Nobody Does It Better. That's my favourite theme tune to a James.
Oh, that was Carly Simon. That was a very good one. I love Bond themes, actually.
Yeah.
Lately, they've been a bit shaky.
Yeah.
I absolutely didn't like the one Adele did, Skyfall, which it just was such a lame song.
Yeah.
And although I acknowledge that Billie Eilish has billions of fans all over the world, literally billions, her videos on YouTube, they have billions and billions of hits. It's extraordinary how popular she is.
Yeah.
But that song didn't do it for me either. No. I suppose Shirley Bassey did three, didn't she? And she has to be kind of up there. But my favourite Bond, despite the fact that I didn't really like the films because they're too violent for me, I can't really watch them, has to be Daniel Craig.
Oh, okay. Well, I think he takes it all too seriously, and there's not enough humour in them, and But the problem was that they had to react to the Bourne films, the Bourne Identity and all that.
They also had to take all the sexism out because those days are gone,
exactly.
And you couldn't have women in films just as a love interest anymore.
No.
It was the public weren't going to stand for
that's
it.
True.
It's a past kind of. Those films are very dated now. It surprises me you say Roger Moore because. He really was just a kind of dirty old man, wasn't he?
Well, I agree with that. And, I see some of them now. But, Sean Connery, Do you remember once in one film, he thought he was going to be cut up by a mad woman with a surgical knife? Instead of which,
isn't that what all men think?
No, I don't think so, no. Instead of which, you know, she just wanted Bond to seduce her. So he took the knife and cut her dress off. I mean, all that kind of stuff. You just couldn't possibly get away from
it. No, you couldn't. But I don't think Bond is really dead. You know, after I saw the last one with Daniel Craig, and I know he's given up because he does all his own stunts, and he said he was just getting too old and it was taking far too long to recover from the injuries and so on. But it said at the end, James Bond will return. It always says that at the end. Yeah. But I don't think James Bond is dead in that nuclear explosion. No. Do you?
No, I don't. I only saw that film about 3 weeks ago. I found it on, not Netflix, but I think on Prime Video. You know, I was just flicking through the channel. I thought, oh, here it is. Very long film. And actually, I thought it was, emotionally, it got to me more than any other Bond film because it's all about...
Because, yeah, he had a child.
His child, that's right, yeah, exactly.
And he didn't know he had a child and she was five by the time he found out and all that. It was very, very sad. Yeah. And also it showed the softer, more feminine side of Bond, exactly. I suppose, because he'd always been quite sort of cold-blooded and reptilian
in a way. He had, but I don't think many of us wanted to see the softer side of Bond. We wanted him to still be going out there and getting rid of the baddies. Hi, everybody. I'm going to brighten up your day by telling you about Harry's, the fantastic shaving experience. They are not just the super sharp razor company. They are much, much more. And you can start with a trial set that is absolutely free. You just have to pay for the delivery, okay? Now, in your trial pack, you get the uniquely designed and weighted Harry's handle. That's a 5-blade cartridge, complete with the precision trimmer, foaming shave gel, and a travel blade cover. Plus, in an amazing free offer, hydrating night lotion spray. It all makes, believe me, for the smoothest shave. Now, your trial set is packaged in beautiful aqua marine containers, which lets you know you're in for something really special. The weighted handle makes you feel you're holding something more than just a razor. And you are. The trimmer blade makes it so easy to get to those hard-to-reach places, okay? The foaming shave gel makes the blade skim across your face like a skater on an ice rink. And after a couple of splashes of night lotion, you will feel positively invigorated. Believe me, I know these things. Now, Harry's products are put together with 0% sulfates or dyes, and are alcohol-free. Absolutely nothing to cause you any concern. Everything is crafted by the experts who've devised invigorating formulas, and you will be able to tell from the minute it touches your skin. So, folks, make sure to support our podcast here, Life on Planet Porky, and start your own skincare journey by redeeming a free Harry's trial set. All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. Let me just stress that, okay? All you cover is £3.95 for delivery. So just head to harrys.com/porky and have your trial set and free night lotion delivered directly to your door. Okay, folks, let me give you that one more time. That's harrys.com/porky. Right, okay, folks, you are listening to Life on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for being with us today. Now, Miss Jones, we've talked before on this very podcast, Life on Planet Porky, about not the exploitation of children, but the way that the rich and the famous, and, you know, we focused on the Beckhams, for instance, their children seem to be a bit directionless and they suddenly inherit careers that they wouldn't have got if they weren't the son or daughter of their parents. And the latest one I want to draw your attention to is Kai Rooney. Kai Rooney, who is the eldest son of Wayne Rooney and his wife Colleen, who, of course, very famous for a court case, as well as everything else. He's 12 years of age and he appears on this massive poster now in the centre of Liverpool, the city of Liverpool, for JD Sports in a load of Puma gear. And at 12 years of age, I'm saying to myself again, I don't know if that's the right thing. Colleen apparently is very happy about it. Proud one, Colleen, 36, shared the snap of a boy lounging in grey Puma tracksuit and trainers, which now adores a huge billboard in Liverpool. I mean, it's going to cause problems, isn't it, later?
Of course it is. What is a kid of 12 doing modelling professionally? You know, why are they not keeping them out of the limelight, just letting them get on with the business of going to school, doing their GCSEs, getting their A-levels, going to university? It seems to me that too many people are trying to fast track a way into a lucrative career without actually putting the basic work in the first place. Yeah. And this does happen with a lot of celebrity kids. Yes. They don't see why they should pay any attention to education because mum and dad have got a lot of money. They can, because of their parents' profile, they can take a leg up the ladder and start to make a living for themselves at a very young age. 12 is ridiculous. And they never have to actually get their heads down and study. And I think that's a very poor lesson and also a very bad role model to other kids.
I just gasp a bit and I think, surely you can see that if, I mean, he's got to go to, you're quite right, he's got to go to school the next day. He's now a celebrity. You know, he's on this huge poster in the middle of, they don't live in Liverpool, they live in Cheshire. And of course, Wayne actually lives in Washington, D.C. now, where he's he manages the football team there, D.C.
But the other thing is, you know, he's not a sportsman himself. Kai Rooney is only anyone. Yeah. Ish, because his father is Wayne Rooney. But Kai Rooney has not achieved anything. There's no sporting prowess there. There's no reason for him to be flogging sports gear.
Exactly, and they don't need the money, for goodness sake, you know what I mean? And I agree with you. You know, surely their job is to protect their children and let their children have a proper childhood, in the way that Paul McCartney did with his children, you know what I mean? You'd never have seen Paul McCartney's children, you know, on the cover of an album or something like that, would you?
Well, you did. You saw Mary as a baby being cradled inside his jacket.
You did on his original LP, solo LP.
McCartney, yes.
But in a way, that was a baby. It wasn't, you know, it wasn't a recognisable, you know, child, if you see what I mean.
Well, yes, it was a recognisable child. I would have to bet to live there. But yeah, it is a different thing. But I agree. Yeah. Paul McCartney sent his kids, Paul and Linda sent their children, to local primary schools and junior schools and grammar schools. Yeah. Stella McCartney, their daughter, had something to say about that in later years. She's a globally successful fashion designer now. Yeah. But she said, you know, in some ways, I wish we had gone to better schools and that we'd had better education and that we would have been better prepared for the life that we had to live.
That's interesting.
As I see that from her point of view as well. Yeah. My kids all went to fee-paying schools, not because I'm a loaded rich bastard or anything like that, but because...
Yes, you were.
You were?
I said, yeah, I bet you wish you were.
Well, I do have my days, but it was just because my former husband and I made a decision that education was very important to us. So, you know, other people choose 5 holidays a year and new cars every year and several houses and whatever else. We prioritized education. And I do think that education is the fundamental of everything in life.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, because it's the way out, isn't it? Or the way in, if you see what I mean.
It's the way in and out. Yeah. You're absolutely
it's
right.
It's the way out of, you know, the rut that we all get into as life encircles us. And it's the way into the echelon. I mean, look, you and I broke out of what you might call the humdrum lifestyle and had great lives because we got into journalism. But my parents gave me a very good education. I went to a direct grant grammar school. And without that, I wouldn't have had the ability or the confidence or the knowledge to have been able to go forward. So I totally agree. Education's everything.
But these Rooney kids, I'm sorry if I'm damning them ahead of their time, but these Rooney children are not going to be university candidates, are they?
Well, why would you go to university, you know, when your father's a multimillionaire and, you know, one of the most famous faces in this country and all that kind of stuff? It's very difficult to know where to go after that. And again, I point to Paul McCartney's son. You hardly ever see a picture of him. He's allegedly a musician and... I don't say that, disparagingly, but...
He hasn't done a lot, though. It's a bit like Danny Harrison, George's son. Yes. You know, they're musicians, same as Sean Lennon, I suppose. But, you know, these guys are in their 40s and 50s now, and they haven't done very much. If you've got Paul McCartney or John Lennon for a father, what's the point, really? Go and do something else. Don't try and be a musician.
Yeah, I think Danny Harrison's done a bit, hasn't he? He's worked on his father's music and he's re-digitalized it and all that kind of stuff, I think. So
he has, yeah, but he hasn't made it personally as a musician, if you know what I'm saying.
No, I totally agree. Just talking about Beatles, of course, let's send...
Because we always do.
We always do, of course. Let's send our best wishes to Ringo, who we heard only a few hours ago has called off some concerts in America.
Well, he's got COVID.
Well, that's what they've said, but that wasn't initially the reason. It was just that he was unwell. If you've got COVID, why would you have to call off at all? I just don't get that.
Because you might infect everybody else.
Yeah, but only for like 36 hours or something. You know?
Also, he might be quite ill with it. You know, he's 82.
That's true.
So he could be quite ill with it. He may not be vaccinated. We don't know.
That's true.
Because I'm a vulnerable, I have asthma. Yeah. I had to have my fourth jab this last weekend.
Yeah, I had mine as well.
Oh, did you have it? I was quite unwell. My arm felt like a lead weight this time. And I was a bit flu-y for about 48 hours.
I got through it again. The first three I had and passed without incident and made me feel better. I think that was, you know, psychosomatic. Oh, I've had the jab. I feel better now. And the fourth one was the same. I just sailed through it, honestly. I did have a very heavy arm. You're absolutely right. I realised when I turned over in bed, oof, that's a bit painful. So where the jab went in, but I didn't have any other side effects.
Have you had your flu jab yet?
No, I haven't been invited yet, I suppose.
Yeah, I'm getting mine on Saturday.
Oh, excellent. Well done. Yeah.
I don't like all that, really, but I force myself to go and do it because, you know, we have to. Yeah, it's necessary.
No, I totally agree. Flu's...
I really hope that Ringo had his.
I hope so. And obviously, wish him all the very best for a full recovery. Just getting back to Kai for a minute. It's not really Kai. This poster is on a corner in Liverpool. As I look at the picture I'm looking at now, which I'm pretty sure was a store called Lewis's for decades. We used to go there at Christmas and my dad and I would go to Everton and watch Everton. My mum and two sisters would go shopping in Liverpool and then we'd all meet up in the restaurant at Lewis's. Now, it wasn't John Lewis, that's a separate organisation. It was just called Lewis's. It was a department store, okay? And it was a focal point of Liverpool city centre. As I recall, it's just opposite the Adelphi Hotel, which used to be one of the great hotels of Northern England. But last time I went there, its standards had slipped a bit, I have to say.
Oh, yeah, me too. Yes, I was there a couple of years ago now when I was researching my John Lennon book. But John Lennon worked in Lewis's, you know,
did he?
Briefly.
I didn't know that.
It's all in the book.
Oh, is it? Well, in that case, I must have passed me by that bit because, of course, I've read your book. It was great. We used to go, you know, week before Christmas, 2 weeks before Christmas. But Lewis's, like, I mean, I don't know these days where to go and buy my shirts or where I'm going to buy my Christmas presents or where I'm going to go when I need new bedding or where I'm going to go when I want to buy a new overcoat, because I used to do all that in a department store called Alders down here in Surrey. It was then taken over by Debenhams down here in Stockbroker Bell. It's now closed down. So I don't know what to do without department stores.
They're a bit old hat, though, aren't they, department stores?
Where do I go now to get my shirts?
Well, you have to go to separate stores.
Yeah, that's what I mean, which is a blinking nuisance. It used to all be under one roof. Are you all right there, Miss Jones?
Yes, excuse me, yes, just coughing at the thought of you trailing around a department store.
Exactly.
You've got to get, like, your bedding. There's no better place to go for bedding than the White Company, so you have to go there. Yeah. Those are beautiful shops. Charles Tirwhitt for your shirts, or Savile Row, if you've got the money. Mm-hmm. Overcoats. I mean, it's Savile Row again. If you're looking for something good,
but hang on, you've got to pay huge prices. Then it all used to be under one store. You'd go into the men's department, and there were your jackets and suits and overcoats. And I don't know.
I do believe this. The more you pay for something, the longer it lasts.
Yeah,
I remember paying, and this is a long time ago, 20 odd years ago. Yeah. You know, Century 21 in New York, which is down Lower Manhattan. Exactly where Ground Zero is.
Oh, yeah.
It faces Ground Zero, the site.
Right.
Century 21, huge big shop. I bought, I'm going to say 22 years ago, it's at least as long as that. Mm. I paid $200, which in those days was a lot of money, probably about £1,000 in today's money. Yes. I paid say a grand for a black cashmere coat,
right,
full length,
right,
which I still wear to this day, and it's still immaculate.
Golly, that's fantastic. I love cashmere. Yeah. I think you're absolutely right. I've got a...
Yeah, it lasts forever. So you pay for something really decent. Yeah. You don't have to keep replacing it every year.
No, totally right. Talking about Lewis's, by the way, and Lewis's is distinct from John Lewis. I mentioned John Lewis. John Lewis, which I think has got quite a few stores, but the main one's in Sloane Square, isn't it, in London?
No, that's Peter Jones. The main one is on Oxford Street.
Oxford Street, that's right. John Lewis and Oxford Street. They're now going into the clothes hire business. Who in their right mind would go and hire clothes to go out to a do and then take it back 3 days later?
Hang on a minute. Men, since time immemorial, yeah, have been hiring top hat and tails to go to the races or to a wedding,
yeah,
or something
that,
like that. Women have been hiring wedding dresses forever.
Yeah.
Also hats, designer shoes, bags, all the rest of it. People have always hired clothes. So what are you saying? Do you expect brand new sheets and pillowcases every time you sleep in a hotel?
Well, no.
Because they've all been used by other people. And the bedspreads, by the way, the counterpanes, yeah, the cushions, yeah, the soft chairs, they're not changed every time between customers.
No, I know. I chuck all that.
So do I. Yeah. So do I. First thing I do in a hotel room is put the counterpane and the cushions in the wardrobe,
yeah, well,
because other people's feet and faces have been on those.
Yeah, I know. I totally agree with you, and get rid.
But there's nothing wrong with hiring clothes, really.
Well, I was astonished to read that Boris Johnson's wife, Carrie, regularly hires clothes for big events. And then, you know, I suppose they deliver them to Downing Street. She puts it on, takes an off day.
Well, she's not there anymore, by the way.
She's not what?
She's not in Downing Street anymore.
No, but when she was hiring clothes to go to big do's and all that. And I thought, how can you do that? I don't know. It's just, you're absolutely right. Whenever I've been to a wedding, I've always, oh, no, I tell you what, I remember going to a wedding once in New York, actually, Manhattan. And I went into the hire shop, that's right, yeah, and this guy said, look, we've got a special offer on at the moment. Instead of hiring this, you can have it for $250. They were selling old stock, you know what I mean? And I said, okay, that's fine. So the problem is, as you grow older, you start putting weight on. So it only lasted about a year, and then I couldn't get into it, and that too.
Yeah, it was a good reason to go on a diet.
Yeah.
But I had a look at the John Lewis site, actually, and, you know, you can hire a dress, a designer dress, for 50 quid for about a week, 10 days,
yeah,
that would cost you £400 to buy. You wear it once to one wedding or whatever the event. Everybody's seen it. You're not going to wear it again. So that dress just gets consigned to the back of the wardrobe.
Right, yeah.
Whereas if you can hire it for £50, why wouldn't you do that? You can also hire really expensive earrings, necklaces, designer bags, all that kind of stuff.
Right.
So you can have a much smarter look for a lot less money.
Yeah.
And also, you're not going to end up with a load of stuff you're never going to wear again.
Yeah,
I think it makes sense. I think it's the future.
Well, years and years ago, I used to buy cars, okay? And then, you know, we all went through the phase of having an office car and all that kind of stuff. And then when I started working for myself again, I started buying cars. And then it suddenly occurred to me, this is the wrong way to do it. So ever since then, I've leased cars, okay? And it is a better deal because you can, for 2 years, you can pay about £800 a month for a car or something like that, you know, and put a deposit down at the start of it. But you get a new car every 2 years. So to that extent, yes, I would agree. It makes a lot of sense. But it's just, you know, you just always wonder who else has worn these clothes before you put them on. But anyway, there we are. Miss Jones, I'm very distressed to see that the decades-long search now for the last remaining victim of Hindley and Brady, a little boy called Keith Bennett with his little National Health Service glasses, it's all started up again, and somebody's claimed that they think they found the grave in which he was buried on Saddleworth Moor. That was the story a few days ago. And now, as I predicted, I actually went on a TV and show and said, this will come to nothing. I said, you can't find people on Saddleworth Moor. It's like looking for somebody in the middle of the Atacama Desert. I mean, it's so vast, and you know, the ground has moved substantially over the decades.
And it's been such a long time.
And such a long time. How could anybody possibly remember, you know, what happened? 50, I think it was 63, wasn't it? So it's nearly 60 years ago now. And the minute I saw that story on the front page, I actually went on to a TV show and I said, look, this distresses me because I can predict this will come to nothing. And the, you know, the guy who said he found new evidence and all that came up with some extraordinary theories about, you know, bone tissue and all that. And simply none of it has been substantiated. I mean, look, of course it would be lovely to return Keith Bennett to his family. His mother, Winnie, campaigned for years. She's dead. But it's one of those where you've got to be so careful about raising people's hopes.
None of us knows how we would feel, do we? No. If, God forbid, one of our nearest and dearest were taken from yeah. us in this kind of way yeah. and that we had no news for our whole lives right. as to what happened to them.
Yeah.
What we can only hold on to is that a body is only that, and the essence of the person has left that body, and remains are remains. There's something very grotesque and gruesome mm. and weird about needing to find physical evidence. Well, it's bad enough knowing that they met their death in such a violent way. Yes, I do think so.
But
yeah.
surely the idea of a Christian burial is closure, isn't it?
Yes, I do see that. Mm. I do see that. But what about when people are lost at sea well, or in a plane crash and there's no chance of finding any trace of remains
totally
or whatever?
I, totally
I think you have to accept that poor woman. I have every sympathy for her, his mother.
Yeah.
I really do. But I don't think finding remains is really the way to heal after such a terrible traumatic thing happens.
Yeah. No, you may well be right. I know you're not a big TV watcher, Miss Jones, but I tuned in last night, actually it was, to a really heavily publicised new programme about Marilyn Monroe. And I had to switch it off after 25 minutes. It was terrible. If you want to watch a programme about Marilyn Monroe, then you want the opening scene to be the famous time she stood over a grid in New York City and her skirt blew up, you know, and she was trying to hold it down. That's the most famous image.
It's an indelible image, isn't
yeah,
it, that one
exactly.
of her.
Instead of which, they started with her as a young child and, you know, some very dodgy goings-on inside her house with stepfathers and all that kind of stuff. And it just completely turned me off. I thought, I don't want to know all this about Marilyn Monroe. I really don't, you know. So it's 3 hours long. I got about 20 minutes into it, and then I just decided not to bother.
Well, this film is based on a book called Blonde, written by Joyce Carol Oates, a brilliant writer whose books I really admire and devour regularly. I have read that book.
Yeah.
I've not seen the film, but I've read the reviews. The reviews are very damning indeed, so I haven't fancied it. But the book is terrific. It is a fictionalized account of Marilyn's life, but it's very compelling nonetheless.
Mm.
And I think what they've done here is taken a brilliant book and made a very poor film out of it.
Right, okay. Yeah, well, that makes sense because I just thought, oh, dear, they want another angle on Marilyn Monroe. I would like to see a film which details her life from the age of about 16 to when she died. She was only about 33 when she died, wasn't she? Something like that.
33, 34,
well,
I think, yeah.
That's right, yeah. And I would just like to see, you know, the amazing rise of Marilyn Monroe, the relationship with the President of the United States of America, all the mystery that surrounded her death, and the way she interacted with her husbands, Joe DiMaggio, most famous baseball player in America, and the great author who wrote Death of a Salesman. What was his name?
Arthur Miller.
Arthur Miller, that's right. Most unlikely husband for Marilyn Monroe, I have to say, but apparently the one who could handle her best.
I think anyone was an unlikely husband for her, but I think the reason she's still a figure of mystery, extremely popular, mythological creature is because we don't really know how she died.
No.
The same as we don't really understand how various people throughout history died, including the dinosaurs, for example.
Yes.
We, you know, the latest theory is that a meteor hit the Earth and all life on it was wiped out at the time, but there's no proof of that.
No, it's true.
And they've tried to sell us the notion that Marilyn took an overdose. Mm. Other people suggest that she was murdered, that maybe the president's office had something to do with that. Who knows?
Yeah. Well,
and I think it's because we don't know that we're still fascinated.
Yeah, no, I totally agree. The latest theory I read was it wasn't JFK, it was his brother Robert. She also
well, she had an affair with him as well,
Robert,
didn't she?
Yeah. But he was the legal officer. He was Attorney General or something, wasn't he? And people working on his behalf paid a visit to Marilyn Monroe, and suddenly she was dead. But it's all allegations, and nobody knows.
It's the Princess Diana conspiracy all over again, isn't it?
It is, yeah. Right, okay, folks, that's it for another week here on Planet Porky. Thank you very much indeed for having joined us. Miss Jones and I will be back with you next week.
He's an incredibly human person. His feet are firmly planted on the ground. And there isn't anything he hasn't seen. And I remember his retirement dinner. They had a wonderful dinner for him at Claridge's. And the great and the good all came. You know, every newspaper editor was there. We all dressed up, hair piled high, long frocks, the whole works. Yeah. I think I even had elbow-length gloves on that night. It was very posh. Yeah. And he stood up and he said, his opening line to his address was, "I think I know something incriminating about every single person in this room."
Wow. Yeah, I can believe it. Do you remember once in one film, he thought he was going to be cut up by a mad woman with a surgical knife? Instead of which,
isn't that what all men think?
No, I don't think so, no. Instead of which, you know, she just wanted Bond to seduce her, so he took the knife and cut her dress off. I mean, all that kind of stuff, you just couldn't possibly get away.
No, you couldn't. They're a bit old hat, though, aren't they, department stores?
Where do I go now to get my shirts?
Well, you have to go to separate stores.
Yeah, that's what I mean, which is a blinking nuisance. It used to all be under one roof. Are you all right there, Miss Jones?
Excuse me, yes. Just coughing at the thought of you trailing around a department store.
Exactly.
You're from Cheshire. You were born in Cheshire, yes?
Yes, born and brought up.
So what do you call yourself? Is it a Cheshian?
No, a Cestrian.
A Cestrian, that's a good word. Sounds like you were born in a cesspit.
No, that's very kind, Miss. That's very unkind, Miss Jones.